On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky here, it is the first program of 2013 of the Common Era. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, a little old internet audio stream available in a wide variety of platforms, including but not limited to TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Radio, Tuner Internet Radio app. And all three of those are available as apps on your smartphone, so you can take the program with it, with you, or even record it at your ease and at your leisure. Also, places like Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku is out there as well. Yes, indeed. And podcasting available through the subdomain for this program at WhiteRoseSociety.org, and you can also pick up the podcast at iTunes. It is indeed the first program of 2013. I'm proud to report that so far, the only time I've had to use 2013, I have successfully named the show file to January 2013. Because otherwise, yeah, it could have been problematic. No, you shouldn't be getting classical music. We're sending. Chat room group is filling up. If you want to, jump right in. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. Easy. Free. And, hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yeah, that part, too. Many thanks to our buddy Randy in Pennsylvania, who got us started for the fundraising year shortly after the ball dropped with a contribution. We are listener-funded in the purest sense of the word, as I noted the other night. You know, like NPR says that they are listener-funded, but their listeners include Northrop Grumman and other associated organizations that build things to drop death and destruction on brown people. So you get the idea. No, it's really ordinary, extraordinary working people who keep this all going. You. And thank you very much. We got to the end of December within our stated goal, and we begin the month of January now. Just trying to keep the wolf away, the lupine pest from off the porch. We try to raise $150 every night, more when possible. We had a wonderful night the other night. Thank you very kindly. Now, tonight we have Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge on the table. Shirley has been contributing monthly for several months now. She's got $100 on the table that she would like to see met by 10 at 10, 2 at 50, and in fact we are $25 of the way there. Thank you very kindly to our buddy Ed. What's this? What's this? Someone is reporting. Ray just sent me an email. Randy Rhodes is reporting that Boner will resign. Well, okay. Is there anybody out there the huffing propane who thinks that the next guy will be saner as long as he's got an R after his name? Really? In his press conference this afternoon, and yes, I know what day it is. We're going to get there. In his press conference this afternoon, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who is still a Republican, I might remind people, no matter how swoony they get over him talking tough to weirdos. He's still a Republican. He still hates teachers. He still despises labor unions. He probably doesn't think much of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or anything that helps, you know, us go on living. But he excoriated the House and said that people like the House leadership, i.e. the Republican leadership in the House, are why America hates Congress. And there's a lot of truth in that. But it was kind of surprising. Well, no. It is disconcerting. I mean, Peter King of New York, absolutely disgusted by Boehner having chosen to adjourn the House without dealing with Sandy relief. And Peter King is not exactly somebody that you would refer to in the same sentence with the word, the adjective, normal. Remember, Peter King is the guy who used to finance a terrorist organization known as the Irish Republican Army. But he was outraged over the Sandy relief shenanigans. The New York Daily News and Chris Christie in his news conference referenced what he called palace intrigues. Yeah. Otherwise known as power struggles. And we all know who wants the power in the House of Representatives, right? That power is desired by none other than Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor. In the words of Shakespeare, he has a lean and hungry look. And so the chain-smoking, Merlot-sodden megalomaniac, John Boehner, is sprouting daggers in his back now. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Wouldn't happen to a nicer guy. And the New York Daily News is reporting that Boehner squelched the Sandy relief in a peak of temper. Because Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor didn't wish to support the fiscal baloney that was foisted upon the American people in the last 24 hours. Boehner was angry, the sources said, when Majority Leader Eric Cantor led the revolt Tuesday by conservative House Republicans against the fiscal cliff compromise. I hate that term. I got an email from Andy earlier today, our buddy Andy, who provided a little background on just where it is this fiscal cliff term came from. The term fiscal cliff was coined by Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. Yeah, that Ben Bernanke. Andy says, yes, he's a Republican, and since Mr. Obama fancies himself one too, he renominated Mr. Bernanke to his post at the Fed. Note that the compromise falls short for us in a number of ways. First, I believe, says Andy, I heard economist Dean Baker say it will cost the average citizen $1,600 more in taxes. Wall Street loves this because it spreads the tax burden, mainly caused by putting back the 2% payroll tax holiday, FICA, Social Security, mainly on the middle and lower class. Well, right, almost exclusively on the middle and lower class because of the cap. Because the folks who know which fork to use with the shrimp don't pay Social Security taxes on income over, what, $106,000, $109,000? Andy notes Wall Street loves that because the rich won't get soaked. No, the market is way up today, 250 points. Sheer happiness. Second, Mr. Obama caved on including tax. Then again, there's that word caved. And I think that's a topic for an open discussion, and it has been mentioned on this program. Is it caving when you wind up doing something that you wanted to do in the first place? That's not caving. That's called getting your way. Right? Seems so. Just one sec. Had to get our Skype all fired up. By the way, didn't we have a blast on Monday? And it was Monday, not Friday. See, God damn it, the holidays just do that to me. No, we did have a blast on Monday for our New Year's Eve program and the Skyping New Year's Eve. You almost think Skype ought to be paying us a little something for all this free promotion. It wouldn't be free, though, would it? No, we did have a lot of fun, and the Skype line is up and hot. But anyway, using the word for what it is, Andy says, second, Mr. Obama caved on including taxpayers making $250,000 and up, instead raising taxes only on singles making over $400,000 and couples at over $450,000 at 39.6. Wow. Oh, he really soaked them. Not. Third, before the Bush 2001 tax cuts, dividends used to be taxed at ordinary income rates, 39.6% max. Now they will be taxed at the 5% hike in the capital gains tax rate at 20%. Wow, Mr. Obama, you really went for the throat of the oligarchs. Not to mention capital gains, mainly a province of the wealthy. Taxes are still below ordinary income levels. Wall Street is happy. Dare we say, Andy, Wall Street is ecstatic? Wall Street is thrilled? Or dare we say, we got effed? Yeah. Economist Juliet Shore, speaking on Democracy Now!, Andy points out, noted that this deal, kind of a broad definition of the word deal, don't you think? Will cost 77% of U.S. families an additional $1,635 a year in taxes. Andy says, just what Wall Street wanted. Have the American people pay for them destroying the economy. A broad tax hike, spread the tax base, socialize the losses, privatize the profits. Good work if you can get it, right, Andy? Yeah. Michael pointing out via email, subject line, the flaccid cliff. If the latest rumors are true, after being teabagged for two solid years, America is finally losing its boner. Hey-o! Yeah, and other things did happen. In regard to, and Darlene's got one of them in the email box here. It was already in the stack. But other things also happened with the chain-smoking, Merlot-sodden megalomaniacs having gaveled the House out of session. Things that matter. And matter to a broad swath of the American people. When the gavel fell, so to speak, and the chain smoking Merlot sodden megalomaniac left to head for friendlier climes, I guess some suburb of Cincinnati, right? Well, they left without passing the Sandy relief bill. That was desperately needed. But remind me, please, to explain somebody who has not been in the limelight but plays a big part in all of this. But there was something else left on the table. And it wasn't a cliff. It wasn't a chasm. It wasn't anything that could that was ever characterized by dramatic music and fancy graphics and big lettered fonts and breathless members of the for-profit media wondering what was going to happen next. It died like the people it was supposed to protect so often die, in darkness and obscurity. What appears to have been the one-term speakership of John Boehner ended without the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. Nearly two decades old, 18 years old, I do believe, the Violence Against Women Act had originally been passed largely as a bipartisan piece of lawmaking that most folks agreed was both called for, rational, reasonable, humane, and of critical life-saving importance. But the GOP, in particular Boehner and Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor, you know why we call him that, right? Because I forget what session it was, but it was a desperately important session being held in the House, and Eric Cantor could not be found because he was holding a fundraiser for himself in Washington, D.C. at the Verizon Center at a Britney Spears concert. No, really. I wouldn't. Look it up. Yeah. And this is the man who has spent the better part of a year or more trying to orchestrate his way into the speakership of the Republican-dominated House of Representatives. This is a guy who actively wants to burn this country to ash in pursuit of his own naked political power. You know, really, I've got a photograph of Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor in front of me right now, and I think it's another one of those time machine moments. I want to take the picture, and I want to go back in time and, you know, just catch Bill Shakespeare hanging out at the Sword and Quiver or whatever, you know, wherever he took a tankard or two of ale of an evening. And just, hey, Bill, look at this. By Jove, that is a fine piece of portraiture. What a miniature. No. I'll explain to you what it is later. You don't need to. What would you say about this? By God, he does have a lean and hungry look. Wait a minute, let me write that down. I don't quite as needly power hungry. This is Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor. He's just nasty. And now, really, no kidding, there's a distinct chance that dude is going to be Speaker of the House if Boehner gets out of the way. After the last couple of days that Boehner's had, I imagine he's way... I mean, I joke about him being a chain-smoking, Merlot-sodden megalomaniac, but at this point in time, I'm figuring he's a chain-smoking, Mad Dog 2020 swizzling straw, drinking through a straw megalomaniac.
Oh, you don't understand me. I'm a speaker. I'm number three in America in line for the presidency, and they don't understand me. Nobody understands me.
Right? You know, even the unindicted co-conspirator, Daryl Issa, of California, a right-wing thug if ever there was one, even he accused, see, he accused, they had their talking points out there early. He accused the senators who cobbled together this package of questionable value of being liquored up. Really? He did it when talking to
all those 89 Wolf
Blitzer.
All those conservative Republicans like Pat Toomey and others, they were wrong.
You know, Wolf, I can't account for what happens after midnight and all that partying and revelry and drinking that goes on New Year's Eve at 2 in the morning. What I can tell you is they did half a bill. The half of the bill certainly is going to be popular in the way of holding down taxes, but the other half is there's no spending reduction. As a matter of fact, there's additional spending. The president has packed this bill with some items he wanted, including tens of billions of dollars for unemployment extension, which is going to have to be paid for. Hurricane Sandy relief, which is between $27 and $60 billion, comes right behind it. That's new spending. The American people told all of us to deal with the deficit. Sure, we'd like lower taxes, but again, I think what Republicans realize is that a lower tax that is only temporary because ultimately you're borrowing the money is not a lower tax. It's a tax deferral. You know, when Speaker Pelosi, when Democrats were in charge, and matter of fact, even when Bush was in and they weren't in charge, they used the word PAYGO constantly. In other words, is there an offsetting pay for what you do? President Bush's tax cuts were not paid for. They were anticipated to be grown out of. These are not anticipated to be grown out of.
Hold up. Did you hear that stunning admission? The Bush tax cuts were not paid for. But guess who was ballyhooing them? Not that you would expect for-profit media personality Wolf Blitzer to stop Daryl Issa and say, wait. You supported the Bush tax cuts wholeheartedly, and you didn't care if they were paid for, right? Because, see, the record is there. But anyway.
Has already said $3.967, in other words, $4 trillion will be added to the debt over 10 years with this tax cut unless we do some spending cuts to help offset it. Right now, the president's still in the spending mood. We need to get him in the savings mood.
I just want to clarify one point. You said it was after the New Year's and they were partying. Are you suggesting that Mitch McConnell and your fellow Republicans in the Senate, they were a little bit drunk when they voted on this last night?
Of course not. I was having a little bit of fun with you, Wolf. The fact is that it was after midnight. It was a piece of legislation that was intended to be passable, not necessarily to be right.
What's interesting, though, is that this Senate as impaired talking point was to be heard again and again. I caught another instance of it when some right-winger derisively referred to the Senate as that bunch of octogenarians, implying that older Americans have no business being involved in the lawmaking process. I'm guessing those octogenarians back home, Congressman Pencil, well, they're just going to love you for a comment like that. But here's one little funny moment of trivia. I'm looking at the story about Issa here over at Think Progress. It's a posting by Igor Volsky. I saw this thing when it first went up. And, you know, there's been, we talk about Senator Lindsey Graham Cracker and his magic closet. Another one of those members of the Republican Party who form a veritable cavalry of people riding lions through Narnia. And there has been, there, from time to time, I think of Sandra because I laugh so much. I laugh so hard when she brings it up. Some reference to chinless Mitch McConnell as well, in that vein, that closeted vein. And it has since disappeared down the memory hole, but when this post first went up, and it was one of those, keep smoking, Doc. You don't have to come in on this. Was it a Freudian slip? Was it just a little bit of New Year's fun? But there's a transcript of Blitzer and Issa's exchange on this post, and it now reads as the audio plays, where Blitzer says, "I just want to clarify one point. You said it was after the New Year's and they were partying. Are you suggesting that Mitch McConnell and your fellow Republicans in the Senate, they were a little bit drunk when they voted on this last night?" In the original that has, I don't know if anybody's got a cached copy or anything, but in the original when it first came out, Igor Volsky, in producing, in copying the transcript, and I don't know if that it was done there at Think Progress or if they just picked it up from somewhere else, but the original transcript read, not kidding, "Are you suggesting that Mitch McConnell and your fellow Republicans in the Senate, they were a little bit drunk when she voted on this last night?" Yeah. I don't know if it's Freudian or just typing. But it was at least humorous. Sandra, speaking of, passing this along, she says, here's something else about the deal. Here's another little gem for you. The estate tax is now indexed to inflation. But Obama is willing to subject Social Security recipients to chained CPI. So this new deal set the estate tax at a 40% rate with a $5 million exemption indexed to inflation. In other words, the first $5 million of any estate would not be taxed, but the rest would be at a 40% rate with that $5 million exemption growing each year with inflation. Says Sandra, yeah, we gotta talk tough to seniors. Because, you know, that's what David Gregory says over at Meet the Prestitutes. We gotta talk tough to seniors. But they won't even talk sternly to dead people. What's the percentage in this country of people whose estates exceed $5 million? Do we really want to be perpetuating an aristocracy, not of merit, but a simple oligarchy, a plutocracy, measured only in dollars? Well, this does that. The estate tax is indexed to inflation, but... oh, Jesus. Some cliff. But yeah, to get back to where I was a little bit ago, the Violence Against Women Act is dead. It had passed the Senate with 68 votes. But the House so-called leadership balked And we discussed this at one point in the show a couple of weeks back. The House leadership balked on reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act because they didn't like the fact that women subjected to domestic abuse and violence on tribal lands could be held accountable by tribal authorities. 30 million women served by the Violence Against Women Act. And what a horrifying number that is to begin with. Are out in the cold tonight because Republicans were worried about Native people's ability to do justice to white folks who abuse women on tribal lands. That's one of those that's one of those Paul Molliv moments, you know, you're soaking in it. Just let that one get you all nice and, yeah. Let that one get through a couple of skin barriers. And let it really, really rattle around. What degree of noxious bigotry and racism has to flow like some sort of filthy undercurrent through the grand old party? In order for that to be a fact. And fact, it is. So now, with the new Congress being sworn in on the 4th, the whole process has to begin all over again. And the whole tormented Senate process that eventually resulted in a 68-vote majority, or a 68-I vote, my God, there were, what, 32 who didn't think it was a good idea? I would respectfully submit to Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey that the Sandy relief bill is not the only reason that a whole lot of America despises the Congress. Anybody want to run out and do the on-the-ground hurry-up legwork to find out who the 32 in the Senate were who voted against reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act? Anybody? Or shall we just guess at the usual suspects? Folks like Jim Inhofe, Lindsey Graham, maybe that noted scholar Jefferson Beauregard Sessions the Third of Alabama Stan. Want to bet? I mean, not bet or anything. I'm not Willard Romney with $10,000 bets to put out there. Interesting, though, isn't it? Anybody who has ever worked in a field, and it doesn't have to be law enforcement, it can be lawyering, God knows it can be social work, it can be in education, it can be in healthcare. But anyone who has ever worked in an area that is touched by domestic violence knows what a god-awful, shocking, heart-rending horror it is. There used to be a statistic out there back in the 90s. It's probably changed since then. But back in the 90s, there was a statistic that said a woman would be subjected to domestic violence 8 times by the same abuser before she would either do something about it or die. You know, Agnes and I were having a little conversation the other day about hardened hearts. And I suggest that a heart that is hardened is no longer a heart at all. It's just some other muscle. Darlene pointing out, she said, I think the RPGs also had a Problem with Violence Against Women Act covering helping immigrant women as well. I would not be in the least surprised. These are miserable excuses for human beings. You got to remember, it's worth noting, one of the people who most despised the idea of reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act was Eric Leave Brittany Alone Cantor. Senator Patrick Leahy co-authored the Violence Against Women Act extension reauthorization along with Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho, you know, the Mormon bishop who recently got busted for drinking some, I guess we'd call them hot liquids, hot drinks. Actually, they were ice-cold vodka shots in Alexandria. But Senator Leahy said the legislation would be immediately reintroduced. He said, we will continue our discussions and we will work tirelessly to have a good bill enacted into law. This is not the end of our efforts to renew and improve Violence Against Women Act to more effectively help all victims of domestic and sexual violence. We've seen enough violence. If we cannot get the Leahy-Crapo bill over the finish line this year, we'll come back next year and we will get it done. But these things have real-world consequences, do they not? If this law goes away, and it is, and it has, if this law goes away for a day, a week, a month, then law enforcement, which has, over the course of 20 years, become accustomed to working within a certain legal framework, it's all gone. Doesn't exist anymore. Until it's reauthorized. And even assuming for a moment that the Senate will get it through, and that's a larger discussion about Harry Reid and whether he's got enough nerve to reform the filibuster rules, the least of which would be to actually make filibustering senators filibuster. You know, strap on the catheter bag, boys, and get talking. But assuming that Harry Reid, well, there's no guarantees. We're talking about one political party in this country that spent pretty much an entire political season proving over and over and over and over again the degree to which they utterly detest and despise one half of our species. The female half. And they say, you know, they'll get something done about the Sandy relief bill, too, just quick as they can. But how quickly is that? 60 days to get a bill out for Sandy relief. The Violence Against Women Act languished in the House. They've been around. They could have passed this. But Republicans don't like to pass those sorts of things. Well, there might be some spending cuts we could find inside the Violence Against Women Act. Because that's where we need to do our spending cutting. And I go back to my original question. Even if John Boehner takes his corkscrew and goes home, it doesn't mean that much, does it? Because the guy who wants that job so badly it feels like it's bending his bones, Eric Cantor, will make you yearn, pine, for the moderate, accommodating speakership of John Boehner. The GOP is not in any wise apologetic for what it does, because they're giving us the medicine we need, and we don't need no spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down either. We will take the bitter draft, and they will hold our nose and put a belt around our heads to keep our mouths shut until we swallow it, even if the medicine turns out to actually be poison, which it is. Yeah, exactly. Bill in Cleveland, Boehner out, so to speak, replaced by Cantor in the same old song and dance. Cantor, song, dance, get it? Yep, exactly. But it is Wednesday, you know. Yes, it is. It's the middle of a very confused week, at least for me. All Christmases and New Year's should fall on Sunday. Or Saturday. I don't care. Pick one. But it is the middle of a very confused week. And the holy days are past. And with a new year, a new revolution of the sun just beginning, I think it well that we remember the faith-based traditions that motivate this planet. Yes, indeed. It is Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the Horn. The Archpope Uber Rabbi, Ultimate Imam, Animated Animist, is still on holiday break. So we'll just take a more equanimical, ecumenical approach to this. With a couple of great stories out of the bosom, he said bosom, of the religion industry. A global industry, I might add, as one story will point out. But let's start with that bastion of rights and compassion
you know. The Roman Catholic Church. Who have done so very much to advance the cause of women folk in the country. They've done it negatively, but I guess it's fair to say. But no, the church just keeps doubling down and doubling down and doubling down to absolutely shocking levels of brutality. You know, we had we've had several stories in the past few weeks. The Pope using his Christmas message to insult and assault marriage equality. The church in Ireland using a religion-driven law that led to a brilliant young woman's death as an argument for keeping that law in place. An Italian priest who suggests that dead women, dead of domestic abuse, need to ask themselves whether or not they caused themselves to be killed. You know, real loving compassion born of the worship of the Prince of Peace kind of stuff. So, in the tradition of Father Piero Corsi, in the tradition of Cardinal Sean Brady, in the tradition of Hitler Youth former anti-aircraft gunner, enter Cardinal Francis George and his six auxiliary bishops from Chicago. And a letter that they sent out to members of the archdiocese and dioceses. Right? The Chicago Tribune reporting. Chicago's Cardinal Francis George and his six auxiliary bishops officially entered Illinois' gay marriage fray Tuesday, and I'd kind of like to get rid of the phrase gay marriage, because it is a matter of marriage equality for all people. Because far from marriage between two gay people rendering heterosexual marriages a sham, it is the fact that heterosexuals are able to get married and avail themselves of constitutional guarantees when a significant segment of the population cannot, that renders the whole thing a sham. Kind of like saying that, you know, gay couples are three-fifths of a couple. The cardinal and his six auxiliary bishops have decided to once again urinate on the Constitution of the United States and upon the laws governing the politicking from the pulpit or the altar, I suppose, of tax-exempt charitable organizations.
by openly advocating bigotry against an entire segment of the population. The letter that went out to priests today said, "Civil laws that establish same-sex marriage create a legal fiction. The state has no power to create something that nature itself tells us is impossible." Damned interesting statement, that. Nature says that it is impossible for two persons of the same gender to love each other, according to the fella in the House of Whoville hat. Nature tells us that it is impossible for two men or two women to be committed to each other within the civil bonds created not by religion, but by law. I didn't know nature knew anything about that. The state has no power to create something that nature tells us is impossible. And yet, here's a guy and six other guys in dresses who actually themselves run contrary to the nature that they say dictates the behavior of humankind. Now, I'm not talking about the church's pedophilia scandal. I'm talking about the church's imposition of celibacy on its priesthood, which, of course, in turn probably leads to some of the pedophilia scandal, but we'll leave that for another day. It takes a lot of nerve to write something like that. Cardinal Francis George is no lawyer, I'll warrant. And for him, in his religious position, to declare what the state does and does not have power to do is just a little tiny itsy-bitsy, teensy-weensy bit on the presumptuous side, don't you think? But then, after saying the state has no power to create something that nature itself tells us is impossible, he then goes on to add, "Does this mean the church is anti-gay? No, for the church welcomes everyone, respects each one personally, and gives to each the spiritual means necessary to convert to God's ways and maintain friendship with Christ." Friendship with Christ. How often did Christ hang out with people who wore garments made of cloth of gold? How much time did Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, spend hobnobbing with the priestly class? Last I checked my copy of the book, every time he got near him, the priestly class was trying to come up with some reason to get rid of him. And it would appear that these folks have done a darn fine job of getting rid of him again.
The Catholic Church in the Archdiocese of Chicago has consistently condemned violence toward or hatred of homosexually oriented men and women. Good pastoral practice encourages family to accept all their children and not break relationships with them.
Except for the fact that those relationships, nature itself tells us, are impossible. It's another one of those lightning bolt moments, just bzzzt. Because, you know, there's feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the people in prison, Nurture the sick. Yeah, there's nothing in there about keeping gay folks from getting married. And homosexuality, well, it's not exactly new. And it was certainly known about back when Yeshua, or whatever the composite of him is, were walking around on the planet for about 33 years. Well, that's very true, Waggy, in the chat room. For lightning to strike, it needs a target that is grounded in reality. God, they're such a nasty bunch. But it gets better. Or worse. The another one of those guys who walks around in a hot pink yarmulke and a black dress. This time, they carry purses too. By God, they are in this picture. They're carrying purses. Not that there's anything wrong with that. What's wrong is being a hypocrite and doing it. In England, at a Roman Catholic church in central London called Our Lady of the Assumption, every couple of weeks, that is a fortnight, isn't it? Every couple of weeks, there are masses held at Our Lady of the Assumption for gay and lesbian Catholics. It's been done for the last 6 years or so. But one of these guys with a hot pink beanie and a little black dress has said, no more. The Archbishop of Westminster has put the kibosh on what are called the Soho Masses. Because traditionalists, read, bigots, objected. The masses will stop, but the guy in the hot pink yarmulke and little black dress says that pastoral care of the community will continue at the Jesuit Farm Church in Mayfair, central London, on Sunday evenings. Vincent Nichols, the guy in the hot pink yarmulke with the little black dress, said, the proper use of our sexual faculty. You know, if I was a Roman Catholic archbishop, I wouldn't say sexual faculty. I just wouldn't. The proper use of our sexual faculty is within a marriage between a man and a woman, open to the procreation and nurturing of new human life. Except among their priests. Yeah, this guy's a real winner. For many years now, the Diocese of Westminster has sought to extend the pastoral care of the church to those who experience same-sex attraction. This care has been motivated by an awareness of the difficulties and isolation they can experience and by the imperative of Christ's love for all. In recent years, this pastoral care has focused on the celebration of Mass at Our Lady of the Assumption Church in Warwick Street. Over these years, the situation of people with same-sex attraction has changed both socially and in civil law. However, the principles of the pastoral care are to be offered by the Church, and the Church's teaching on matters of sexual morality have not. Morality. So they're still defining the private determinations of love between two consenting adults as a question of morality and not of the love Yeshua instructed people to bear one to another. Nice bunch. But you gotta love the hats. But lest anybody think that this is some sort of anti-Christian bromide, let's take a quick visit to our allies, our dear friends. Remember when George Bush went a-walking through the Bluebells holding hands with the King of Saudi Arabia and went to kissing on him and stuff? Remember that? I think that's long about the same time George was talking about having him a mandate. I don't know if he understood the meaning of the word. No, bigotry and hatred are in no wise limited to the followers of the Prince of Peace. It's also available to folks who follow the Prophet. A prominent Saudi cleric. Remember, Saudi Arabia is our dear friend. We created... The United States did the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia by supporting the House of Ibn Saud against the House of Hashmi. A prominent Saudi cleric who can't do diddly in the so-called kingdom without the approval of the ruling family. Man, where's a guillotine when you need one? A prominent Saudi cleric has issued a fatwa, which is a religious ordinance under Islam. Now sit down. That calls for the gang rape of Syrian women. You heard me right. You know why? Well, it turns out the Saudi government has been funding the Syrian civil war. Funding the opposition to the Assad regime. And they've had some success, but not as much as they would like. And with that in mind, this particular imam, operating under the authority of the royal family of Saudi Arabia. This particular imam has been worried that maybe the Syrian rebels aren't getting the job done because they're fatigued and horny. I'm not kidding. He's worried that the rebels in Syria are so tired from fighting and have gone without sex for so long that their spirits are flagging for want of sexual congress. He has called for hours-long intercourse marriages with Syrian women and girls. I wish I was kidding. He said the intercourse marriages last only a few hours, quote, in order to give each fighter a turn. Gang rape. And this doesn't mean that the whole gang of guys goes and finds a whole gang of girls. This is conceivably one or two women who are raped time and time and time again. Peace be on the Prophet! So that they will be better fighters. But it's not just any woman, mind you. I mean, there have to be rules. This is not Vietnam. The women to be gang raped have to be at least 14 years old. and they can be either widowed or divorced. You know, what's fascinating is that one of the things that motivated the prophet, if I understand correctly, was the way that the poor and the widows were treated in the time before his revelations. A woman who had been widowed, who had no son to care for her, was, for all intents and purposes, sentenced to a miserable death by starvation. So that the Quran, the first thing the Quran does is impose upon believers a duty to care for the sick, the poor, and the widowed, and the orphaned. Now, this all happens in Saudi Arabia, as protests continue in India over a gang rape of a woman simply traveling on a bus. It continues, this goes on against the backdrop of another girl in India who killed herself rather than be married off to her rapist. This is the kind of thing that... historical perspective. This is the same thing that we held war crimes trials over in Japan over what were the Korean women called? Pleasure girls, forced prostitution at the service of the Japanese military. You reckon we'll lodge a formal protest? Comfort women. Thank you. Thank you. In the chat room. Comfort women. Yeah, I'm guessing we won't issue a formal protest. That's their internal politics. That's their freedom of religion, isn't it? Widows and divorcees. You know, because marriage is sacred, right? Yeah, and apparently, no, Marty, no virgins. Yeah, no. These tired, worn out, flagging, spirited rebels can't have virgins. They have to wait until they go to their martyrdom to get 72 of those. But if you think this won't be published to the rebel forces, well, I wouldn't take that bet. Religion. Religion. Salvation of the soul. I mean, is there anything in this fatwa about the gang rape victim becoming blessed? I mean, does she get a cookie in paradise? Somehow I'm guessing not. That's a starting place for us this evening, isn't it? I should hope so. Of course, your thoughts, your stories, whatever is on your mind, is, well, this is a forum that is open for that. You know the number, right? 304-658-3333. One of these days we'll try to get the toll-free number out of Hawk, and that'll be really nice when we do. 304-658-3333. The Skype line is open as well. The contact here is Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. You can get through either way you prefer. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com. And a little reminder, if you're having trouble finding the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com, there's some work going on. And if you prefer to contribute, just go to PayPal and send the send your contribution directly to the email address with which the PayPal button is associated. That is bobkincaid at gmail.com, BobKincaid at gmail.com. And choose personal and gift, and it will that way you won't have to pay the transfer fees that normally associate with such transactions. We're $25 of the way toward reaching Shirley's $100 challenge for this evening, and hopefully getting January off to a rousing start. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Light up the lines. We'll get the conversation going. This is The Horn.
Step out of life. It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes past the hour on this midweek prayer meeting edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I'm tickled to say that we are now halfway toward meeting Shirley's challenge. Only $50 to go for the next hour and, in the next hour and 45 minutes of the program or so. Many thanks. Many thanks to Shirley. Shirley is one of those that I have met on my trips to Wisconsin, and well, we really appreciate the kindness. All right, then. The conversation part of conversation radio really is the heart and soul of what we do here. So thus, let us go straightway to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Howdy do, Jim. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I had this thing, I was imagining that on New Year's Day that you were dressed like Baby New Year's or something. Maybe it was a nightmare, I don't know.
That would be a nightmare, Jim.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
Well, how was New Year's Day?
Oh, it was wonderful. I completely immersed myself in, what's that quote you use, the intolerable pursuing the inedible or something, whatever. I was a college football watching fool.
I can only imagine the, unmentionable in pursuit of the inedible by Oscar Wilde.
That's the one.
Yeah, that's it. You got it. Well, I spent mine, they had a Twilight Zone, marathon, and, after watching the news and stuff like that, I thought I'd be better floating around in the Twilight Zone, which I am half the time anyway. So, I mean, hell, what's the difference?
I understand completely.
What was the name of the song you just played? It had a nice bridge to it.
Oh, that was Culture Club, and that was Church of the Poison Mind.
Oh, my Lord. Well, you know, maybe you should have played Love Shack by the B-52s, or...
oh, everybody wants to be a DJ.
Or, let's see, Do You Want to Funk with Me by Sylvester, which really makes a lot of sense.
Or maybe Cruel to Be Kind, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I was just thinking about your...
But, you know, the fact of the matter is, Clayton wrote in a couple of minutes ago, and he said... And now I know why I didn't or don't trust the Syrian rebels. Yeah, these are the folks that we want to have topple the Syrian regime.
Oh, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. My life, for an imam or a cleric to issue an edict or a fatwa that would encourage gang rape. I mean, we're not talking about the Soviet Union entering Berlin. I mean, they had a reason for that, at least. At least I can see some justification for it, but this is ridiculous.
Well, we must remember that the royal family of Saudi Arabia, you remember how the King of France used to be styled the defender of the faith by the church at Rome?
Well, I think it was the King of England, wasn't it?
No. It was the most holy and pious defender of the faith. It could be conferred on just about any nobility, but the French king was particularly proud of being that. Well, that's where the Saudi the royal house is in regard to Islam, because they are charged with the protection of Mecca and Medina, and they are also more or less the guardians of the purity even of translations of the Quran, and they take it very, very seriously. And so for one of their sanctioned pet imams to issue something like this reflects upon the Saudi royal house, most assuredly.
I hope the Saudi royal house would have enough sense to bring this man into bring him to heel for something like that, because that's just crazy.
Well, remember, one of the top princes of that royal house just recently paid for a brand new Airbus A380, you know, the great big giant one?
Mm-hmm.
And it will have mechanized prayer rugs that will at all times orient toward Mecca, no matter where the plane is in the air. So, you know, they're right pious, these folks.
Well, that's okay. I mean, if they want to spend the money for something like that, and they have a lot of money to spend, and if they can make software that can produce that in an aircraft, I mean, why not? I mean,
No. I'm not talking about the rightness or wrong. I'm saying that they're very serious about their faith, and that includes, I guess, allowing divorcees and widows of greater than 14 years to be gang raped, and encouraging it.
Well, I don't understand that. I mean, what about masturbation? At least you don't have to look your best.
Well, I can see we're starting the new year off in rare form, Jim.
Well, it's true.
You don't have to look at all.
Well, some people might, but I mean, nonetheless, I mean, you know, good Lord. That's just the craziest, most barbaric thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yes, it is.
And when did this happen?
Oh, this is recent. The story is dated today. Let me find the original story. The guy is said to be very influential in jihadist circles. And this story was dated yesterday.
No doubt.
His name is Muhammad al-Arifi. He is, of course, Wahhabist. He calls it intercourse marriage that lasts only a few hours in order to give each fighter a turn.
Intercourse marriage?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at the gravity of what you just said, but the name, it's just amazing, the names that these people or the terminology they use to describe these ridiculous.
Oh, there's more detail, Jim. He described his fatwa as solving what he calls their sexual problems, the men's, of course, and quote, boosts the determination of the Mujahideen in Syria and is considered a duty to enter paradise for those females who enter such marriages.
Okay.
So not only if you are a good Wahhabist Muslim woman in Syria who is divorced or widowed, not only is it okay for you to be gang raped, you're supposed to throw yourself down for it.
Hmm. Oh, well. You certainly flummoxed me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, could we just fly some C-130s over and drop blow-up dolls? I don't, that's a little bit facetious, but the fact of the matter is, this is brutal. This really is the kind of thing that we convened war crimes tribunals over following the Second World War in Japan.
Yep.
For the Korean comfort women.
Well, yeah, that's what they're still called today, because Kim Jong-il was supposedly surrounded by hordes of comfort women. Must have had too many, because it killed him. That and all the porno movies he used to watch and all that brandy he used to drink and stuff like that. Ah, God in heaven.
Jesus.
I'll tell you, it's just nuts, isn't it?
Well, if you could take that all out of context and get the Islam all away from it, I'm sure there are some fine, upstanding fundamentalists here, Christian types, who say, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, Bob, I don't know about that. I mean, come on, let's...
John Hagee? You know, the guy that... Starve! Rod Parsley in Ohio, who said that the war in Iraq was a Christian duty?
Oh, I don't know, Bob. John Hagee and these other people you're talking about, they could even rape themselves, much less somebody else. My God.
Well, okay. I mean, I've seen, well, not naked, but I've seen pictures of John Hagee. He probably hasn't, well, say this. Let's just say there's some overhang in the way of the view.
Yeah, I guess so. Kind of like Mount Rushmore.
We ain't talking about Lincoln's nose.
Something like that. My God in heaven. Oh, Lord. That's...
Well, you know, it's like Lottie in the chat room pointing out they're only doing just what the Christians did during the Crusades. And that the truth in that. You know, when the Christian Crusaders took over Jerusalem, they raped everything that wasn't moving.
Even the cattle?
I would say, and the goats weren't safe neither.
Now I know where that expression comes from, a place where men and sheep are nervous.
Terrified.
Yeah, absolutely. My Lord. That is something else. It really is. And is this going to be endorsed throughout the entire Muslim world?
I can't imagine. Well, since it's being put forward by a Wahhabist, and the Wahhabis are a subset of Sunni Islam, and since it's being endorsed by put forward by a Wahhabist, I would imagine that the Shia faction will say absolutely not, because they can't agree on what to have for lunch, and haven't for 1400 years.
I guess so. I don't know what to say about that. That's kind of blew me off my feet. So you said that the speaker...
Well, I've been watching for it. I haven't seen anything about it yet, but...
Yeah, I've been looking for it, too. I mean, he looked as though he was in pretty rough shape today.
Well, you know, if you'd gone from Pui Fuse down to Mad Dog 2020, you'd feel a little roughed up, too. I mean, John Boehner has a real alcohol problem. And it's been noted in the past. But, no, I'm not seeing any of the media outlets reporting that he's on his way out.
Well,
sometimes people, even on the progressive side of media, just say things.
Well, you know, he had he was really upset about something. He has a big set too before he adjourned the House.
He told Harry Reid to go F himself.
And of course, they said that Harry Reid said, you go fuck yourself too. I don't blame Harry Reid for saying it. Yeah. But I mean, he was just really in a fine state of mind, wasn't he?
Yeah, and apparently the people in New York and New Jersey got screwed because Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor wouldn't go along with Boehner on the deal, and they threatened to scuttle the whole thing. Yeah, this is a hostage situation where two of the hostage takers can't agree on who's in charge. And you know, sometimes in those very fluid dynamic situations, you'll actually have internal coups, and that's what looks like is happening here. Eric Cantor has decided that the chain smoking Merlot swilling megalomaniac has got to go.
Well, you know, they could self destruct. Basically, that's what I've been hoping for, as far as these crazy Republicans are concerned, and some of the stuff they've been trying to force down people's throats. They will self destruct eventually, because they're on the outer skirts of the lunatic fringe to the point that I don't think they're really rational people.
They're not, but don't think that they're self-destructing, because if some, you know, the whole goal of, if there really is an internal power struggle going on, the goal is toward getting Eric Cantor into the speaker's seat, and I'm not kidding, if you thought John Boehner was nuts, you're going to love Eric Cantor.
Well, is he the only, selectee?
Well, he's next in line.
By what, seniority or what?
Well, he's the House Majority Whip. He's supposed to be the Speaker's chief lieutenant. You know, he's his enforcer.
Oh, I see.
But for a year now, Cantor has been making it plain that he was going to do his own teabagging stuff. His own teabagging thing.
Oh, by the way, speaking of teabagging, reference my email to you. If you really want to know how the term teabagging evolved, you need to see the following movie.
1998 film?
1998. It's called Pecker. It was written by John Waters, starring Edmund Furlong, and of all people, Mink Stole and Patty Hearst.
That has got to be a film for the ages.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It is crazy, and you've never heard of where the term teabagging really came from?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Well,
and I know about rusty trombones and Cleveland steamers too, but you know.
Okay. The nomenclature sort of defies description, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But the thing is, we don't call them teabaggers to insult them. We call them teabaggers because that's what they called themselves at the very beginning of their movement.
If only those people had seen that movie.
Oh, no, I much prefer that they didn't. The irony is far too delightful.
Well, there you go. But anyway.
Oh, by the way, I know you'll be interested in this. Secretary of State Clinton has been discharged from the hospital in New York.
I just saw that over the TV, and I'm real happy. She had gone for tests, and then they brought her back, and now she's been cleared, and I'm certainly glad to hear that. I certainly am. My God. I just wish she had been elected president instead of Obama. But, you know, that's just me. Maybe I'm all wrong about that, but I think she'd make a fine president. I really do. I'd hope for that.
Yeah, well...
That's the only point at which my sister and I could ever agree.
That she would be a fitting president?
Uh-huh, absolutely. I mean, we did agree on that, and I will never forget that. I said, I'm going to have to mark this down on my calendar, that you and I finally agreed on something politically, and that was about Hillary Clinton. Of course, my sister, in her own way, is a very ardent feminist, and I respect her for it, and I can't blame her for it, but then again, she sort of kind of borders on other things that, well, make me wonder. But nonetheless, that was a real eye opener for me back during 2008 or whenever it was. But nonetheless, I'm glad Secretary Clinton is okay.
Well, I think she still has to be monitored, and I guess no more foreign travel for her. And you know, the thing that was disgusting about the front end of all that was people like Sean Hannity giggling about it. And okay. Saying, oh, sure, she has a concussion. Sure she does. When, in fact, anybody who's ever been on an airplane knows that they are pressurized cabins. And there are even warnings for people who are at risk of blood clots and things like that about, you know, taking care of yourself. And the woman was in the air all the time.
I know. I don't know how she maintained that schedule. I mean, you know, she was in one place one night and coming into another place at 2 o'clock in the morning, and after deplaning, having to have meetings with people at 2 a.m.
Yeah, she did the job, or she at least tried to.
Yes, she did. But
I would think that this, you know, because health problems are a real devilment to any potential candidate. And this, and you know, she hasn't even said that she was interested in running in 2016. And this may put paid to it all.
Well, I would think it might. But I've always had the greatest respect for Mrs. Clinton. I always have.
Meanwhile, at least two people, Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, the libertarian ophthalmologist, they very proudly voted against the so-called deal, which is no deal. But they did so to appease the, you know, so that they could stand there in front of the Republican base in 2016. And I stood up to that. You know the drill.
Unfortunately, I do. Well, listen, I don't have a whole lot to say other than enjoyed your telephone New Year's Eve, or not telephone, but your marathon Skype thing New Year's Eve. That was a lot of fun. And
it was. I think we're going to have to try to figure out a way to do it more often.
I thought you were going to have something after midnight, but
no, it didn't materialize. I got back too late and just got on. The group was still there, and we just chatted for a little bit. And, a couple hours, really. But, yeah, I had to sort of go out and drive around for 3 hours while I waited for Ferg's social engagement to come to a close, and then picked him up, and we all came home, and it was just quiet after that.
Well, that's good.
We had our Hoppin' John yesterday with our black eyed peas and our rice, and we had our hog jowl and our cooked cabbage, so we took care of all the luck traditions, and we ought to be okay now.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm glad you had a good New Year's day, and as they say, God's in his heaven, and all is hopefully will be right with the world, and who knows.
Yeah, and stay out of Syria.
Yeah, I would definitely do that. Absolutely.
Take care, Jim. Have a good night.
Good night.
Bye now. Let's keep things rolling. Go over to the Skype line. Sandra's with us. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I gotcha.
Oh, okay. I never know. I mean, I sort of tested, but, you know, it's, you know, when you go live, things go wrong, right?
Well, and Skype, there's I noticed it the other night. Skype takes a couple of minutes or a few seconds, and it learns, and it'll settle audio down.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I noticed that, whatever. I don't know. Skype, I mean, it works for what it is, I guess. Did you hear about this this new study from the NOAA?
I'm not sure what.
Okay, well, this is it's just crazy, but apparently the amount of methane leakage out of the fracking fields.
Yeah.
They thought the industry was saying, "Oh, maybe 3% or some madness," but this new study is suggesting a rate up to 9%.
Damn.
Which completely negates any sort of transfer from coal to this madness, because methane is like 20 times more potent than CO2.
Yep.
I mean, it's just, it's just some crazy, it's outrageous, because that kind of gas will, I don't know. I just read this as in Nature, and I'm just like, what they gonna do to cover this up? And apparently, they have to make other tests in different fields. They don't know if this is just out of the Colorado and Utah fields, but if that's the case, it's hideous. So this will poison the water and contribute to like runaway climate change, all this fracking, and all of it just sounds, I don't even know how to wrap my head around it. Anyway, I just thought I'd share, because I was just sitting here shaking my head thinking,
Well, the other thing that I caught along the way was this delightful story out of the Arctic.
The runaway rig?
Oil platform, yeah.
Yeah, with 155,000 gallons of whatever. And, it's like, in the meantime, it's facing 40, 50 feet waves. I mean, we're talking about super duper crazy ass climate conditions. It's a joke.
Right. And I loved the report out of the New York Times that said, a Coast Guard helicopter flew over the rig after the grounding at 8:48 p.m. It ran aground and, quote, detected no visible sheen.
Well, no, but the thing is, it's just everyone, all the environmental warnings, everyone said that they don't know what the hell they're doing. And this was just, you know, just waiting for it to happen. And Shell, they don't have anything to say. They're just scrambling and demanding more contracts and saying what? You know, what is their solution to this runaway rig that's subjected to some of the freakiest climate in the world is up there?
Yeah, I mean, anybody who has watched that Deadliest Catch thing knows that those are not exactly balmy and benign waters.
No, I mean, yeah, anyway, I just, yeah, that story is disturbing, too. It's just, you know, their answer to the sort of open ice is to go up there and, you know, extract more sort of, and who knows what all that drilling up there is doing to, you know, my pet thing, which is this methane gas.
Right.
I'm sorry. I just think, you know, it's like, you know, what in the world? I just don't understand. I guess there's some school of thought that, oh, you know, there's not much methane, but then the IPCC didn't even include it, and they announced that they won't be including any methane information in the next one that's due out at the end of this year, I think.
Right, because, well, why bother?
Right, but it seems
because
to be...
Because I guess that's the bottom line for me, Sandra. These thugs are going to do this no matter what, and one of the things that we fail to take into account is that the Arctic up there, once you're technically out of territorial waters, it's no man's land. I mean,
I know. Yeah, I mean, the law of the sea, you know, makes it clear, but they hadn't thought about, oh, we're going to have law of the ice. You know, this wasn't an issue when those treaties were drawn up. I mean, that's how crazy the climate change is. We're only talking about a generation and a half removed from those international governance, you know?
Yeah. But meanwhile, the Coast Guard says, we are now entering into the salvage and possible spill response phase of this event.
Wow.
Possible spill response phase. And the thing is, that's kind of Orwellian, because I don't know if they mean there's a possible spill or maybe they would be able to respond to a spill.
Okay, so... it's like if there's pockets of methane being released, oh, why not just add some oil to the mix? Who gives a F? I mean, that's like really pristine areas up there. And what, Shell is going to spill their disgusting oil-gas mixture and just say what about it?
Right. So, and what happens when, say... let's say they're successful in getting one of these things down, because as brutal as North Sea drilling can be, it ain't nothing compared to this.
Well, that's what I mean. I was just sort of reading about the elements, and I just can't wrap my head around, you know, how they sort of convinced the state to allow them to do this. It's so irresponsible and so disgusting.
Well, this is the price we pay for not letting them drill in Anwar.
Well, it's just, you know, I don't know. I just, like I said before, you know, Obama's legacy around this shit is maybe what he will be infamous for.
Well, and that goes back to the story that I had a few days ago saying that the reason Lisa Jackson stepped down from the EPA was over a disagreement with Barack Obama over the Keystone XL pipeline.
Oh, is that right? I didn't read that story. How interesting.
And if that's the case, then I guess we're all pretty much waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Okay, so she wouldn't be telling him, oh, you must do it, and I'm going to resign because you're not going to do it. We can assume that.
Yeah, I'm not. I ran that one through my head too, and it didn't compute.
Right. I'm just saying. I mean, I don't think it would have been that. It's the other way around, where he is about to say yay to this madness, right?
Right, and you have to consider the political realities around it and sort out the whys and wherefores. Maybe I've gone too paranoiacally into deep baseball on this, but or inside baseball, but you had two constituencies inside the Democratic coalition. One was the environmentalists, and most of the environmentalists can arguably be said to be Democrats. I mean, you've got some third partyists and so forth out there, but it's mostly Democrats. But the environmental movement doesn't have any serious walking around money. On the other hand, you've got labor, and you've got a substantial number of labor organizations that do have some money and did do work for Barack Obama and do want this pipeline to go through because they want the jobs.
But, I don't, you know, I mean, there's the sort of farming constituency, which was a little bit of a pushback too, right, along with the environmentalists. I mean, strange bedfellows. But didn't you have that element going on?
Yeah. That was a Republican constituency in large part, the folks in Nebraska who didn't want it going over their aquifer.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, I guess we just have to wait and see. I shouldn't make assumptions, but, you know, those sort of personnel changes, that's always a telltale, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the only other thing I wanted to tell you was I was reading in the Plumb Line, which is in the Washington Post.
Right.
And apparently some meeting between Boehner and the president, his speaker, it says the speaker told the president to his face that everything you want in life comes with a price. And this is talking about the upcoming ceiling hell, right? Debt ceiling?
Yep.
That price doesn't change here, the Republican aide said, that Boehner said. I don't think he has any choice. So these, and once again, the media is so disgusting because they're trying to pretend that allowing the U.S. government not to pay its already incurred debt obligations is a negotiating tactic that is comparable to Obama cutting all the entitlements for. I mean, Obama needs to come out and educate the public about how completely, I think it's almost unconstitutional what the Republicans are attempting to do again. But he kind of shot himself in the foot when he agreed the first time, too. So, you know, because it's outrageous when you think about it. These are debts that we've already agreed to pay. This has nothing to do with a give and take.
No, these are pre-existing obligations.
Right, and you know, it's just stunning that the Republicans are setting themselves up to do this again. And unless the White House and the Democrats are ready to call them on it and use the bully pulpit to make people aware, because the media's not, is making it a equal side business again. It's just disgusting.
Oh, it absolutely is. And there's some theory out there that's whereby Obama could take unilateral action. And I don't fully understand it, so I'm not going to try to explain it. But I saw it referenced by a fairly smart guy, lawyer type, on Facebook the other day. But my first thought was, my God, the impeachment proceedings would be, I mean, they wouldn't even bother to have hearings. They would just take a vote in the House and have done with it.
Yeah, but it is, I mean, from what I can tell, it's completely unconstitutional because, you know, we're supposed to cover our obligations like this. So the raising of the ceiling is just perfunctory. You know what I mean?
It shouldn't even be subject to legislation.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's just, I mean, it's outrageous. Because if you look at history, it's been risen over and over again. There hasn't been any element of controversy around it. And now we have this situation where, you know, the Republicans, you know, gave up, in quotes, all this business, knowing and setting it up, thinking that, oh well, no worries, you know, in 4 weeks or so, whatever, we'll be able to, you know, hold the whole world hostage again. And, you know, of course, Obama will cough up what we all want, which is the restructuring of the social insurance program.
Yeah, the destruction of the social insurance program. Right.
Yeah. Anyways, but I'm just kind of, you know, it's just a bit of a worry, and unfortunately.
Well, what happens if in fact Boehner is on the ropes? What happens if you've got Speaker Cantor? How much weirder does it get? If Charlie Pierce is calling them feral children now, what will they be then?
I don't know. I just sort of, you know, a part of me thinks, well, that first go-round just really shouldn't have happened. And there was, like, endless yelling from our side about the whole thing. And, of course, we're just accused of being, you know, dirty hippies or whatever they call, right?
Right, yeah.
And then now Obama is sitting around talking about, oh, I won't be, you know, I won't negotiate. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm sitting there thinking, it's not really something that I would, you know, use to cover, you know, to cross a stream with, you know, what he's saying.
Right.
There's no way. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm not believing you, Mr. Obama, because you said that you wouldn't allow the taxes to not be risen above $250,000. That was an adamant promise, and, well, what do we have today, Bob?
If $400,000 or $450,000 for a couple, if that's middle class now, can you and I just, and the rest of the Horn family, can we just go ahead and admit that we are straight up lower class trolls? I mean,
the group who makes between 250 and 450, well, they are just it's a good day for them.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. That is apparently now the new definition of middle class: $250,000 to $450,000 a year.
Yeah, it's a joke. I mean, anybody who is surviving, you can survive in any city in this country, like a king, if you make that much money. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I mean, that's, and yet, did you hear the explanation? Well, you know, if you've got a couple of kids in school at $60,000 a year, you know, you're not really making that much money.
Well, no, but see, that's unbelievable. I mean, once again, it's, you know, the Washington behaving like Versailles, you know, where the proles are just not even a part of the story, you know, which is what we talked about, you know, on New Year's Eve. But, it's just stunning. I'm still stuck on that in estate tax business. I couldn't believe that. It's like, as inflation goes up, that $5 million increases, so you can hold back even more. But for indexing of the Social Security, oh no, we have to keep that and skew it and force old people not to consider health care costs or anything. And that's not even, you know, the irony is just so disgusting and so disturbing.
Right, and that's like, you know, it's like Texas Betsy just asked, so only parents of kids in private college should get the $400,000 limit?
Yeah.
No. But by the same token, you know, you can go to some pretty highfalutin state schools if you can get in too, and wind up in some pretty serious coin.
Oh no, all of it is becoming just out of reach, you know. Anyway, and this whole business that Washington just spent the last whatever time doing was just catering to the only constituency that matters to them:
Wall Street.
Yeah, and those people,
to let the Violence Against Women Act lapse, and to let the Sandy relief bill, you know, we'll get around to it in the new Congress. Bull. I mean, unless Harry Reid does something, Isn't the 60 vote supermajority going to remain in force, full force in effect? It's no longer an election year, Sandra. They're not the loonies like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and this new creep coming in from Texas. They're not gonna. They got absolutely no reason to behave as sane human beings whatsoever.
Well, and the fact that you have a chance to set the rules when you have a new Congress, and they're already the whole filibuster thing is apparently already falling apart, tells me that the Senate is acting in its own self-interest. They want to remain a illiberal governing body that negates, is it the 17th Amendment when they decided to elect senators? Is that the right amendment?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, because it turns kind of back to that. If this is a majoritarian governing body, then it might as well just be appointed by whatever corporate interest is in charge of whatever state, because it's the same difference. We're not getting the proper representation because 60 is supermajority, not majority, and nothing, absolutely nothing, we'll get through.
No. Precisely my point, because I don't think we will ever, I don't think we'll see the Violence Against Women Act. And I don't, and whatever, and the $60 billion that was supposed to go for Sandy relief, I'm betting will be a pittance if they pass anything.
Oh, no. I don't know, unless they may have to go the sort of emergency responder way, you know, how they shamed them mercilessly to get that money for those poor people after a decade of waiting. I think, you know, they may get bombarded with, because that's a whole bunch of people, millions of people quite close to their dumb ass who's being affected. So I'm not too sure how long they can screw those people over. I'm sure they're going to get bombarded, but the idea that Boehner just yanked it because of his little wah, you know, I'm like, oh my God, these people are out of control.
Oh, they're nuts. I mean,
because he was upset because he's been slighted. It's like, bitch, this is nothing to, you know, nothing to do with your personal feelings. I mean, that's how he is. I don't even know what to say, because what's behind him is equally as disturbing, if not more, at Cantor.
The only possible thing, and I saw it mentioned in the Horn chat room, is that they could screw themselves up so thoroughly that they wind up electing Nancy Pelosi Speaker again because of an entire Democratic minority that gets behind her, and then a factioned out Republican Party. I don't know if they're that dumb.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The whole thing is just beyond disgusting. I really don't know where that's going to go, but it doesn't bode well for what Obama may want to do with his second term. I'm telling you. I mean, his lame duck status has really increased just behind this first little deal.
Which points out the, you know, and I know people go, ooh, when I mention it, but in recent history, one of the worst things we may ever have done was term limit the presidency. Because every second term president starts quacking the day of the inauguration.
I mean, it is a bit, it's just a bit, yeah, it definitely is.
And that's not me saying I want four terms of Barack Obama, but by deliberately term limiting a second term president, we have effectively kept the president from being able to occupy that administrative leadership position that the role was created to be. You don't have anything, politically there's nothing to fear from a man who or woman who can never run again.
Yeah, no, it is really, you know, the state of the system is becoming intolerable, though. That's the thing. I mean, it's no longer just dysfunctional. When you can, like, sort of dismiss the help for that superstorm, you know, we got big problems, and all we're doing is lurching from one crisis, self-inflicted, self-created crisis after another. That's what we've been doing for most of Obama's presidency, which is a good argument for maybe not electing nobody of color anymore. No, I'm joking.
No,
anyway.
Well, but there, you know, there. I read an article over at Truthout that was reprinted from Australian Options magazine. It's called "There Is No American Left." It's like they've been listening to our conversations. You know what left? Mm. But the ending paragraph of that just really sort of opened. It made me stop and think, and good writing does that. The mid-late 20th century may or may not turn out to have been the high point of human civilization. Progress may yet return. But if it does, and this is the important part, this is the part where I went, oh, damn, somebody gets it. If it does, it will not be led by the United States. It will be resisted by the United States. It's up to the rest of the world to provide the hope for the future that once emanated from Washington, New York, and California. Otherwise, you will become just like us. Isn't that the truth? Isn't the United States the single greatest impediment to going forward as a species on this planet?
No, the thing is like, you know, I was taken aback when I started taking, you know, fairly obscure international relations courses and when you're in those kind of classes, you know, you get to hear a little bit more. But just to understand that several other constitutions are what all the international law is veering towards. I mean, it's not the U.S. anymore. And, you know, that was a bit of an eye-opener to me because, you know, every American is propagandized. It's not until you study some history or if you're lucky enough to do undergraduate, graduate work that you get to sort of have a look-see. And, there's elements of this country that, you know, it's just totally finished on some levels, at least as far as laying the mapping for society.
Yeah, play the music, right? I mean, it's done.
Well, Isaac sent me this. Al Jazeera buys current TV from Al Gore.
I just saw that too. I find that really interesting. That'll give a lot of cable systems reason not to put current TV on. I'd love to have current or Al Jazeera on my crappy cable system, but it's headquartered out of somewhere in rural Virginia, and the odds of me seeing either one of those on my TV, we're not going to have none of that jihad television.
Well, back to the Constitution, I was laughing because I guess there was an article in the New York Times about how bad the Constitution is. I don't know, I can't remember the name of it. It was just recently complaining about it. You know, how we should maybe just get rid of it. And, I was looking at my Twitter feed and that Glenn Greenwald, I guess he's about to pop some sort of vein. You know, and I'm thinking, yeah, dude, you know, I like his stuff, but it's like, well, you know, getting the vapors about our Constitution at this point, you know, it's just hard when you know all the sort of, how it has not been used for so many groups, you know? So.
Or to understand that it was designed not to work. I mean, it's the same degree of frustration I get whenever I hear some starry-eyed progressive talking about getting our democracy back.
Right.
And, you know, my first thought is what democracy? Back from where? Just find me one time in this country when this has been a democracy. Like I said the other night, the only time we've ever had meaningful, positive social change in this country is when there has been, for all intents and purposes, no opposition. And that's, you know, and it's pretty easy to define. If there are no Republicans, you can get some work done. Or in the case of the Civil War Congress, when there's no Southerners. And maybe that's the common thread, is the South.
Well, I mean, it was sort of, you know, I mean, maybe people should have been aware of how dubious the Constitution was when Rhode Island rolled it out for the people to vote for it, and they promptly voted it down.
Right.
You know, the only state to get a taste of it for ratification that wasn't just foisted upon them. You know what I mean? I don't know. I always thought that was a kind of interesting footnote about our Constitution and how quickly, oh, we're not going to do that anywhere.
Well, look, I mean, look at the Federalist Papers. We were discussing this the other night. The Federalist Papers are propaganda pieces designed to argue in favor of the ratification of the Constitution, correct?
Mm.
And they were written by three people, but most of them were written by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, both of them writing under the same pseudonym. Now, what does that say? I mean, the advocacy of the Constitution of the United States was born in fraud.
Well, and who was sitting around talking about, was it Jay, the first Supreme Court justice? You know, the people who own the country should run the country, and that's about right.
Well, and that was certainly Alexander Hamilton's argument, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, the whole group of those men who wrote it all in secret, you know, the whole real history of the Constitution, which is always entertaining.
Well,
you know,
I'll never forget the candor of that brilliant scholar from the University of Wisconsin, John Kaminsky, speaking at the Prism series, who said you don't get, if I recall his words correctly, you do not get the Constitution you have if James Madison is not a slaveholder sitting around with a ton of leisure time in which to think big thoughts.
Yeah, no. That is interesting. I mean, much like Tony, what's his name? Kirshner, who wrote the screenplay for Lincoln. I guess he didn't look at any Du Bois or any kind of history on, you know, where the black folks were.
No. What is it? There's four black folks in the movie.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's kind of disturbing. I know it's a decent movie, but how do you do that? You know, I mean, oh my God. But anyway, that's a different conversation.
Well, it is, and I like the movie a lot. I thought there was a lot to it, of real quality.
No, and he's a good guy. I'm not being critical. It's just kind of
right.
The lack of the sort of real historical.
Well, I saw this beautiful phrase.
Dynamics
beautiful quote the other day that was a take on George Santayana. You know, the guy who said those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And some wag had added after it, and those who do learn from history watch the people who didn't repeat it anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's just the Civil War is always, I don't know, I just, yeah, I'll just leave that.
No, but there's, you know, like I said, whether it's the Civil War Congress or the Depression, the first Congress under FDR or the Congress after the Kennedy assassination, the window that opens is very, very narrow, and it shuts in a hurry. And the only way anything gets accomplished is with the obstructionists out of the way.
Well, I saw a video, I guess, it was a CBS News where they actually talked about this quote pending trade agreement, the Trans Partnership, TPP?
Yeah.
Trans-Pacific. That horror show. Yeah, Trans-Pacific Partnership. And they were talking about New Balance, the shoe company.
Yeah.
Now, you know, they just focused on that one last American type of shoe company.
Yeah, I used to buy those because I could at least once in a while find a Made in USA label.
Yeah, well, they can, if this trade agreement goes through, that could end that shoe store. But I was just taken aback by, you know, how matter of fact in general they talked about that trade deal. Because, you know, you and I know that if that trade deal goes through, it's world corporate governance enshrined. But I just was, you know, taken aback by how casual they were about it. But so get yourself ready for that one.
And it will be ballyhooed as the one thing that will save planet Earth, right?
Or some madness like that, yeah. Anyway, but they, you know, it's problematic because they had the last round in New Zealand this past December, and there was like nonstop protests down in Wellington, I think, where it was held. So there's starting to be a fair amount of pushback outside of the U.S. And funny enough, around the really aggressive and oppressive intellectual property rights that emanate from Washington. They're like the worst on the planet, and they're trying to force that on every country now that they take agreements with. And New Zealand's kind of like, we don't know about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and thank heavens that they do.
And Australia is saying no to the investment guarantees, that is, companies being able to sue the hell out of governments when they can't get the profits they want because, say, the people want to protect their food, stuff like that.
Right, and I'm seeing some pushback out of in the Canadian press about that stuff as well.
Yeah, so anyway, we'll see. And like they said at that trade website, sunshine has a way of destroying these deals. So,
we'll
see.
You hope, but by the same token, we leverage a lot of negative pressure, and that's the sad thing.
Yeah.
I mean, take for instance what I was talking about the other night, the German feed-in tariff law that has enabled their renewable energy revolution. I read that book, Clean Break, and lo and behold, the inspiration, the German Energiewende, the energy change, the Clean Break, as it were, the inspiration for that came from Jimmy Carter. The Germans cite Jimmy Carter as the visionary of the late 20th century, while Sean Hannity and that crowd are doing Carter jokes and talking about malaise. The Germans say, oh, no, he got us out of our comfort zone. We realized listening to him that, you know, there was something to be done here, and there was big business to be, and there was money to be made. And lo and behold, it is literally all born out of things like solar panels on the White House roof.
I mean, that's incredible. But,
and remember, the solar panels have been found. They're still in storage somewhere. Bill McKibben took them to give them to the White House, give them back to the White House. And they canceled the appointment, they canceled the meeting, they didn't want to be anywhere near Jimmy Carter's solar panels.
Well, that's because I guess Obama is setting us up to experience resource curse and petrostate wonders and, you know, all that.
Right. I mean, I saw the photograph, getting all the way back to the beginning, I saw the photograph of that Shell platform, the exploration platform they were trying to drag up through those 50-foot seas.
Right.
It's round, Sandra.
No, it is. It is just like, it's just the whole thing is just crazy. It's unbelievable.
So, you know, instead of, God knows we can't have Jimmy Carter's solar panels back on the White House roof, but we can drag round coracles, giant oil coracles, through 50-foot seas in the Arctic Ocean. Sure.
Yeah. Oh no, so sir. Well, listen, I should let you go, but I have to comment on that Republican beat the hell out of Tony Romo, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
I should mention that kid is a Republican, but I'm always taken aback. But yeah.
Yeah. The best thing out of that Cowboys game was the line that came after. In a fit of temper after the game, Tony Romo threw his helmet, and that too was intercepted.
Listen, I felt horrible. I even felt kind of bad for him. That's like yikes. Anyway, he might be trading, huh?
You begin to wonder. Of course, we've already missed the big fun for the evening. They're gearing up for the Sugar Bowl down in New Orleans, and lo and behold, the ESPN crew have already brought on Timmy Tebow to consult with him on the Gators' fortunes.
Oh, no. You mean he's doing color for that?
Commentary there on the pregame, sure. And they had him. Oh, and here's the fun part. They showed him talking with Emmett Smith, you know, another Florida alum.
Oh, yeah.
I would just love to be inside Emmett Smith's brain, going, kid, I'm in the Hall of Fame. Everybody who was watching at that point, you got a little Emmett Smith highlight reel in your head. Remember the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
That run. Son, go sell shoes. You ain't a football player.
Well, I mean, aren't they predicting that he's going to be like some sort of, you know, circus act down in Florida next season?
Well, you know, did I read somewhere that he's asked to be traded?
Well, yeah, he would be. I mean, what is a disaster for him in his little career? Because what does he do in New York?
Not so much.
And they need to shake themselves off of that cutie pie too, from the looks of it.
Yeah, he's got a bad case. he's got a bad case of Romo syndrome.
Oh my God, you know the state of that. But anyway, I couldn't even keep up with the list of the hatchet job on Monday. They got rid of loads of folks, huh?
Oh yeah. Of course, yesterday I was lost in a football wonderland. Did you happen to see the lick that the kid from South Carolina put on Denard Robinson from Michigan?
No, I didn't get a chance.
Sandra, just look it up. Just his last name is Clowney, Clowney. Look up Clowney, Michigan hit. I mean, oh my God, he put a hit on, because Denard Robinson was like the second coming of Jim Thorpe at one point, you know, because he plays at Michigan and
right.
Alabama completely exposed him at the beginning of the season, and then yesterday, with everything on the line, Mr. Clowney delivered a lick that Denard Robinson's ancestors felt.
Oh my God! Okay, well now I have to look up that highlight. Oh no, but sorry, are you getting your popcorn and getting yourself right for this madness on Monday?
Oh yes.
Oh God!
Oh,
you know what?
I just saw the footage of the tide. Yeah. Oh, say it, Sandra. I interrupted. Say it.
No.
No, I want to hear it.
That's it. That's all you're gonna get.
I gotta hear it. I talked over it. I'm so sorry.
Can't do it again. You missed it, man. But you get the gist of it. I got to go there because, I hope they beat them so bad, too. You see what I'm saying? I want a beat down.
Yeah.
Badly.
Extra digit for the scoreboard beat down.
Really bad.
I want an NBA score.
I want them to run it up. I don't care because it's already making me sick hearing about it. But you know what? The thing about it, they're going to get some huge ratings. We know this.
Well, you know, there's, I think I may have mentioned, there's already big bulletin board material in the Alabama locker room. That whoever the genius entrepreneur Notre Dame fan is who produced that towel that says Golden Domers versus Mobile Homers.
You know, that's some hate. That sounds great. That's a good one.
Well, I'm damn sorry I talked over it, but we know you said it. We heard you.
That's right. Oh my God, but still.
Well, no, yeah, I mean, I would root for the devil himself against Notre Dame, and well, Nick Saban is, you know, Nick Saban.
No, it should be entertaining. You know, I don't know all the ins and outs of Alabama. So are they fairly low scoring type of just what kind of, I mean, what kind of,
it depends. It depends on which team you get. They can play 6-3 games. They're not in the best of shape when they get into one of those shootout affairs where they have to keep up. But you know,
right.
they can lay down a beat down, but the Texas A&M game with that what do they call him, Johnny Football, that won the Heisman?
Right.
Yeah, that was a bad day, and it was a shootout. It's almost like Texas A&M was still playing Big 12 football, just flinging the ball all over creation. I don't think Notre Dame's quarterback can throw that way that well.
Right.
But they got a line that can handle. And they got a good senior quarterback with a real good head on his shoulders. So hopefully I'm ready. I'm psyched. I don't know. I'll make people mad at me. I may take the night off for this thing. I mean, you know, the guy's got to have his popcorn, right?
Well, yeah, I listen.
And by the way, you got a note in from Marty. He said, bet with you and Sandra, Denver and Seattle in New Orleans for the Super Bowl.
Oh, right. Oh, my goodness. Now that would be entertaining. What?
Yeah, that would be. I mean, you know, Denver's got home field throughout. Bless their hearts.
Seattle is playing damn good right now, too.
Yeah, they are. What I find interesting is after losing really dumbly to the Vikings this past weekend, lo and behold, Green Bay has to turn around and play the Vikings again in the first round of the playoffs.
Yeah, but, you know, that's absurd because, I mean, the Vikings, they only have a one-trick pony. I mean, he's amazing, but, you know, they shouldn't be able to do that back-to-back. But, hey, who knows? Peterson is good, but it is a team sport, right?
Yeah, no kidding. And Christian Ponder, he ain't the second coming of Eli Manning.
Yeah, but anyway.
But speaking of Mannings, there will be some noogies delivered if Denver makes the Super Bowl because, sure. You know, that family, man, I wouldn't want to be around the Thanksgiving table with them.
Oh, God. But, do they have home field, right, Denver? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, all the way through.
Shut up. So they have a bye this week?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay, so Peyton Manning really set them up nicely, huh?
You know, the neck held up, I guess.
Oh, you know what? All that is just, it is just sick, you know? One hit type of thing. Is that to set up there?
It kind of is, yeah.
Well. Good luck to him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to. And, I mean, this should, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm rooting for Louisville big time tonight, just because not liking the Gators has been real easy for me for a very long time. But it's kind of like last night with Northern Illinois in the same bowl game as Florida State. Bless their hearts, they hung tight for three quarters, but then it was just a fish in a barrel.
Well, listen, let me ask you something right quick. Now, see, I don't follow this sport at all. Not interested unless there's some black person getting beaten with a hockey stick. Then I sort of tune in. But what's happening with that sport? I mean, are they done for the season?
I don't know. I don't know if they're completely done. But there's a lot of really pissed off fans. That much I know.
No, but it seems really idiotic.
I didn't think anybody.
What?
I didn't think anybody could be more stupid than Major League Baseball about money,
yeah,
as far as owners are concerned. But the hockey owners are rewriting the damn book.
Because they keep coming out every few, it's been canceled up to, and now I'm thinking, well, it has to be pretty much the whole season at this point.
Well, but they play, but for God's sakes, playoffs included, they play till June. I mean,
that's right.
Theoretically, that's right. I guess they could do one of those foreshortened seasons like the NBA did, right?
Oh, right. Well, anyway, I just was wondering because.
By the way, Marty, just with a reminder, he said, if Indianapolis happens to beat Baltimore, you get Indianapolis at Denver.
I'm not really on that bandwagon. I find the whole thing, and it was like, I'm sorry, it was cringy. The whole coach coming back from the cancer treatment, all that was like, OMG. I know I sound horrible, but I'm like, oh my God, you know? It's just a bit morbid. Oh, are they going to feed off of the la la la? You know, the whole thing is just yuck. So, health go Ravens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the thing, you know, Indianapolis versus the Ravens has its own dynamic because, you know, that's the Colts. That was Baltimore, right?
Mm-mm. Oh, yeah. That's right. Yes, yes. Well, I didn't. But that, I guess that's a, that would be like dynamite for the ratings for them, though, right?
The grudge match and all of that. Sure.
Oh boy. Oh well. Anyway, I guess we're sort of drifting into like, oh my God, can they stop talking about sport part of the show? So I'll let you go.
Sandra, have a good night.
Yeah. You too.
Bye now. There has to be time for some shameless shallowness on this program, and there's nothing better than American sport to cover that base too. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, how you doing?
Good, Andy. How about you?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Hanging in there.
Well, yeah, and by the way, thanks for the heads up on the origins of fiscal cliff. I wonder how many people know that.
Yeah,
it's a Ben Bernanke joint.
He was the one who first coined it, no question about it. And it is a shame that he's even there. I mean, he shouldn't even be there. If Obama wasn't a Republican, we might have a real somebody with some progressive or more FDR-like leaning type of a Keynesian policies in there. But we get a Republican, Ben Bernanke, a holdover from the Bush. He was a Bush appointee.
Well, Ben Bernanke was what we got when we figured out, when even the neocons figured out that Ayn Rand's little love child had sold us all a bill of goods. You know
what
I'm
talking about? Right, talking about Mr. Ryan.
No. The former chairman of the Fed.
Oh, Mr. Greenspan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he spent his youth sitting at the feet of Ayn Rand and licking her toes or something. It was really gross.
I could say something, but I don't think I will. I think he went a little further than that. Is Rand
right? But I'd rather my eyes not start burning before with 30 minutes to go in the program.
Right, they're both so ugly. It's hard to even contemplate. God, they're ugly. Both their minds are ugly. And
oh yeah, Ayn Rand sitting Ayn Rand, the objectivist, sitting there with her Medicare card and her Social Security card in her pocket, chain smoking Pall Malls while Alan Greenspan looks at her longingly from down on the carpet. Yeah.
Well, really, she didn't get the wide berth of promotion until the neocons and these teabaggers came out. That's what really boosted her sales and her books.
Well, no, even before the Tea Party started, I remember a conversation with Reverbo several years ago, where we were talking about the Modern Library list of the greatest books in the last 100 years versus the that's compiled by academics, and then the popularly selected books. 3 out of the top 10 are Ayn Rand books. No kidding. You know, it's Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and some other piece of crap.
That could be too volume buying by right wing groups. The Koch brothers throwing a few million dollars in, and the Heritage Foundation, the Cato, all these American Enterprise, man, they will buy these books and they give.
Oh, I remember when one of the bank executives
gave them away for free.
I remember when one of the bank executives for BB&T endowed a chair at Marshall University in Huntington in the economics department, I think.
Right.
Maybe philosophy.
Ayn Rand aficionado, that guy.
Yeah, and he endowed a chair in Ayn Rand's objectivist studies.
Right, so they buy up these books and they give them away for free. And the universities might make people buy them when you have these courses that are funded by these right-wingers, these millionaire, billionaire types, executives who endow these chairs, whose books go with it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it was. Maybe that third book on the list was "We the Boring," or "We the Living." I'm sorry. oh, God, I just can't abide to read her.
Oh, those books,
have you ever sat down and actually tried to slog through?
Years ago, I can remember having Atlas Shrugged. I remember.
I just remember getting to the sex scene and reading it aloud to Agnes to howls of derisive laughter from her. And you know, her, stop it, Bob, you just quit it right now. Enough of this.
Yeah, it grossed me out then. Hey, you had Jim on. I know Jim can't defend himself, but just two comments since Jim was on earlier. He likes to talk about Ralph Nader quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I happened to catch Ralph Nader the other day on the radio, and he made this comment. I think that was pretty good. He goes, you know, these Democrats, they just constantly beat me over the head with Al Gore's loss in 2000. But nobody mentions that there were 250,000 registered Democrats in Florida. Jim, I hope you're listening. 250,000 registered Democrats in Florida who voted for Bush. Far more than the Green Party votes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What happened? What was that all about? How did 250,000 registered Democrats vote for Bush?
I would say that's a product of Southern Democratic politics, Andy. And until you've lived down there and experienced it, it's really kind of hard to wrap your mind around. You've still got maybe in Alabama, a huge Democratic registration.
Right.
And they will vote for that, but they are a la carte voters. You know, the South had not voted for Republican presidential candidates in quite some time until Ronald Reagan came along, and the myth was created of the Reagan Democrat. What they are is mugwumps.
Right.
They couldn't be trusted with the carcass of a dead skunk. But you know, maybe their county sheriff is a Democrat, so they want to do the right thing by him, and they'll register that way. But their leanings are essentially right-wing conservative. Because,
right.
I mean, I remember being down in Alabama in 2006 during the primary election season. And whether it was a Democrat or a Republican, every single ad that ran on TV or radio said, and Bob Thumbfingers has family values that mean something to us down here in Alabama.
I know you bring that up. Well, you know, talking about the South, I saw this statistic about Mississippi, which I thought was interesting, is that Mr. Obama only got 10% of the white vote in Mississippi, supposedly. This is the stat I saw, and I saw it in the New York Times, so it must be fairly relevant anyway, and knock on wood. But 10% of the white vote in Mississippi, yet, as you brought up, he only lost by 146,000 votes.
Right.
In Mississippi. That's amazing. That if he could just, if they could, Democrats could just switch, get some of those white voters, a little bit working class people, just a little bit smartened up. God, Mississippi should be a blue state, or at least a state that's up for grabs. You know, that just amazing how skewed that is.
Oh, it is.
Every minority in that state must be voting Democratic for them to come that close if they're only getting 10% of white voters.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And that demographic cannot hold for much longer. It's a product of gerrymandering and voter intimidation and voter suppression. Jack in Shreveport points out, Andy, by email, he says, historically in the South, people have registered as Democrats so they could vote in Democratic primaries, and there could still be some holdover of that now from the closed primary system.
Yeah.
And that's what I meant about the sheriff. If you're in a state with a closed primary, Alabama's had open primaries for ages, which I think open primaries are just stupid.
No, I agree, totally.
Because people keep thinking that primaries are elections. They're not. They are nominating processes.
Right.
You could just as easily have a little local county convention and select delegates to go to a statewide convention. I mean, the Green Party does it that way. There's a Republican convention in Utah instead of a primary. That's how, remember, you know, that freak Mike Lee? that's in the Senate.
Caucus system, I think, a lot of places.
Yeah, but that teabag freak that's in the Senate from Utah unseated a longtime incumbent.
Right, who was a pretty far right in his own right.
Yeah, but he wasn't weird. You know, he wasn't weird enough.
Right. Well, no compromise is broached by the teabaggers.
Oh no!
There will be no. It's going to be hard line. You will maintain the line. You step any kind of compromise. That's why Obama bugs the living hell out of me. And he just bugs the hell out of me.
You mean because he's trying to behave functionally in a system that is dysfunctional? When the system's that raises the question, Andy. When the system is dysfunctional, does that become essentially dysfunctional because it's outside the norm of dysfunction? I know it's kind of a head turner, but
he's very, very foolish. Now, let's put this in context, just with the inheritance tax that you were talking about with Sandra, and I sent an email on that. The inheritance tax, in context, before 2001, before the Bush tax cuts, it was 55% after $1 million in inheritance. That was the baseline before and another point of fact, the inheritance tax has been as high as 70%. It was that way for a long time, particularly during the war years and the Roosevelt era. It was 70%, not 55. Now in context, it's 35%, right? So Obama wants to get to 45, and what does he go out and negotiate? He says, and he wants a $3.5 million limit, you know, cutoff for it, instead of the... $5 million in context, it's $5 million now and 35%, right? So he comes out and says what he wants. He wants 45 and he wants $3.5 million. Well, if that's what you want, you don't say that's what you want.
You say you want more than that.
Right. At least go what it was prior to Bush, 55 and 1 million, if you want 3.5.
Well, didn't we hear that all during the campaign? Let's go back to the Clinton levels?
Yeah, can you at least bring us back to where we were? God, I could pop my head right off. He's trying to pull the wool over our eyes with his baloney. And God, point of fact, it's been 70%. If we got a $16 trillion deficit, the rich should start paying up because they're the ones that put us in this deficit. I don't care what anybody says. It is them that put us there with those wars that were unpaid for because there is no tax base coming in. And we have guys dying for them so they can live this effing great life that they have, just butchering the working class, right? And here they are, and they get, and he comes off, and he negotiate the 40% at $5 million. They don't give an inch on that limit. Like I said, I think that's only 0.3% of all estates that, you know, come into estates from people dying. 0.3% is, I think, what I've seen of all after that $5 million cutoff, which he didn't get a nickel on to get him to 3.5. But it is so ridiculous. Who is he kidding? He never wanted the 45 and 3.5 in the first place. Never wanted. He just wanted to give to the oligarchy. You know, that's what bugs me. He just gave it away.
Well, you know, by the time he's done, he will probably be above that $5 million threshold. He was probably just thinking of the kids.
He's just there for Bill. He just wants to become another Bill Clinton, get his $100 million, and live the good life. Screw the working people. Screw the middle class. Just bring us further down into an abyss, just like Clinton did. He's going to do the same thing, and he is doing the same thing. The joke. Like I said, it's $1,635 for the average taxpayer, 77% of the population. It's going to have to chalk.
And see, I mean, there's two ways of looking at that part of it. Haven't we been living in a taxation fantasy land across the board, Andy?
Yeah.
I mean, I want the wealthy to pay a greater share of their wealth as taxes. But even working America, and I hope I don't get a bunch of shit over this, is if you look at the tax rates in civilized countries, how far below that are we?
On the top marginal tax rate, I've seen figures where they looked at, I don't know if it was all the developed world countries, I doubt it, but I know five of the other big nations.
Developed, thank you, that's higher, yeah.
All have higher top marginal tax rate. France is at 75% now. They're the highest.
Well, but that got struck down.
Well, he's going to fight it.
Yeah, well, they're going to try to find a way to make it constitutional.
They're the highest at like 55. Without that, they're 55. That's what they've been. He tried to raise it another 20.
But, I mean, even in the working class, it's my understanding that the tax burden is higher in developed countries.
Yeah, because they get a lot more.
Because they get services. So,
the front end,
I think we're missing an argument here to a certain extent, Andy, and that is that there are certain things that the working class wants and that the working class is willing to pay for.
Sure, and because when you pool money together, you can usually, and you can bargain with large amounts of money, you can usually get it cheaper for the vast majority of people than going to the private sector, particularly when it comes to health care.
Right.
You know you're going to get ripped off. Here's the numbers I have. France, the top marginal tax, 55.5 now. Italy's at 50. Germany's at 43.9. The UK's at 41.6, although I know theirs is going down. Japan's at 37.6. Those are effective.
Yeah.
And no, maybe they're not effective. I think they're statutory. Oh, no, they're effective. They're actually effective. They have the U.S. at 29.8 effective rate. So those aren't even the
actual statutory rates, right?
They're the actual effective rates. France, 55.5. Italy, 50. Germany, 43.9. UK, 41.0. Japan, 37.6. Ours is 29.8. Those are the top marginal.
Are Australia and New Zealand on that list?
No. So I don't know. That was just in the Financial Times in October 24th, 2011, to be exact, if people want to actually look it up. But that's not right. It could be even more countries and more countries than that. That was just a list given looking at some highly developed countries. And then the dividend tax, too. If you go back before the Bush tax cuts, dividends were taxed at ordinary income tax rates. Whatever your income tax rate, that's what you paid the dividend tax. But Bush made it so the dividend tax was wrapped in with capital gains.
Right, and that's the real piece of dirty business in this.
Right, because dividends, like 80, 90% of all dividends go to people in high tax brackets, 1 or 2%. It's highly skewed. You know, it's something like the top 10% of the population get like 70% of all the dividends. And so it's a joke.
And so basically,
bring it back to where we were. He won't even do that, you know, right?
Because somewhere, somebody has told him that taxes are bad. I mean, this is all.
He's doing it for the oligarchy.
Where? You know, where was the memo that Keynesian economics is dead?
Right.
Because I didn't see that.
We do better as a country. We grow better when the rich are taxed more because they don't add to.
And they get richer, Andy.
Yeah.
The rich got immeasurably richer under the Clinton economy.
Sure, the GDP's growing. Profits are growing. Everybody's spending money. So all the boats get lifted. And, of course, if the people that are taking in more of the profits, the capitalist class is going to take advantage of those profits. Yeah, you're going to pay more in income taxes and capital gains taxes, but even when you have high capital gains, it's baloney to think that low capital gains taxes is going to do anything to increase the economy.
No, all that...
It doesn't. There's no justification for low capital gains, low dividends taxes.
I mean, that doesn't even encourage people to reinvest in the market, does it?
The lower capital gains?
Yeah. I mean...
There's some there because when you do sell your investment, whatever it might be, pay less on taxes, but I think Warren Buffett is, people don't look at that. You invest in something because you think it's going to gain in value. You don't worry about the taxes at the end. You invest because you think it's going to have a high rate of return. And the taxes is a foregone, it's something not really, that doesn't play as much into the analysis. Because still you need that high return on that asset.
And yet, meanwhile, by comparison, if a family has some sort of household crisis and has to tap into, say, a retirement IRA,
you're going to pay taxes, right?
And you're not just going to pay taxes. You're going to pay. That favorite word of the right wing, confiscatory.
Yeah, you get penalized, man. Get penalized.
I mean, you don't just get taxed; you get hammered.
Absolutely, you do. No, that's another. That's a whole other joke. I can get into that. You know, if you're not making any money income-wise, I mean, you can't even put into your IRA. Even if you had the money from savings and wanted to add that year, you can't do it. You're not permitted. That's another joke. Kills me.
Right, because we. But that's because in a consumer
$1 million IRA.
In a consumerist economy, we don't actually want people saving money, Andy. I mean, we say we do. But we don't. We want that money constantly cycling into the into the constantly chewing maw of consumerism.
Right, right. Absolutely. Hey, a number of other quick items. You were talking about Germany a while back and how the German guys were saying that, you know, he couldn't see ever getting a Green Party to head up and take over in Germany, get the chancellorship.
Yeah.
One thing I think I mentioned to you, you know, remember back, a guy named Joschka Fischer under Gerhard Schroeder's chancellery, under his government, he was a social democrat, I believe, was a Green. And he was a foreign minister, vice chancellor, Joschka Fischer.
But the main thrust of what I was told was, you know, like creating a Green majority inside the parliament.
Right. That's not going to happen. But it's hard to happen for any party, no matter what it is.
Yeah, because you so often have to form coalition governments.
Right, right. But Joschka Fischer got up there, at least got to the number two spot as a Green. That's pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, we were talking about the Red Dawn, that film.
That god-awful piece of movie making, yes. Wolverines!
Right. And just so your listeners know, that film was completed and done as the Chinese being the protagonist.
Yeah, it all had to be changed by a CGI after the test marketing.
Right. It had to be digitally altered afterwards because of all the flack they got. And according to this BBC piece that I heard, a lot of that flack came from Chinese trading partners.
Sure.
Meaning Wall Street people were not happy that they were putting China in a bad light. So the Wall Street people were putting pressure on the producers of that film, you know, about future funding.
Yeah.
For, hey, don't let our good friends in China who were raping and pillaging with their low-cost labor, hey, don't put them in a bad light.
No, I mean, it's like that story I had a few nights ago of the letter that was found inside the Halloween decorations. My God, that
right.
Just made my blood run cold.
That was something else. That was something else. And I hear, I was just listening to the BBC. I heard a guy named O'Neill from Goldman Sachs, one of their top economists, saying how, you know, people should look at how bright 2013 is going to be for China. Their automobile industry surpassed Europe. They're going to make 19.8 million cars. The economy is still like an 8-9% GDP. They're over the hump. The real estate market is coming back. God, life is wonderful if you're in China. I think about that article. Yeah, not if you're a low-level worker, Jack.
Yeah, and not if you're a member of Falun Gong, who's been sentenced to a labor camp without any sort of judicial process.
Right, right. And then, too, you know, we talked about Proposition 37 here in the U.S. You know, the final numbers came out on that. And even though, you know, we were outspent 5 or 6 to 1 by like $46 million, we got up to 48.6% voting for that. The GMOs, genetically modified.
So what kind of limitation is there on the ability to bring it back?
I don't think there's any, as long as you put together the signatures, you know, as long as you get the signatures on the ballot. That's the big hurdle. It's not an easy process to do when you're doing a volunteer network to put that together.
No. But I hope it does come back. I hope it comes back because I want it to survive the constitutional scrutiny. That's incredibly important.
Yeah, I agree. It would have been a wonderful thing to watch.
Because, I mean, you know the thing's going to go up on questions of preemption and primacy and things like that.
Right. And the final vote here in California, too, Obama won by like 23% of the vote. Yeah, that's good if you're just looking at tallies, but, hey, he won by so much. You know, I just think it's basically a throwaway vote. You want to vote third party, vote third party. Jesus, when you win by that much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I still, my experience with third parties, Andy, here in West Virginia, is with the Mountain Party. And I have a lot of friends in the Mountain Party, people I respect dearly. And the game is rigged, okay? You've got to always have somebody running for the vanity seat in the hopes of keeping enough of a percentage of the vote to remain on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who do that, I respect. But we have got to get, and I know it does happen in some places. We've discussed this, and Preston and I have discussed this. Somewhere within the structural apparatus of third-party politics, progressive third-party politics, there have to be decisions made that we're going to run people for county commission. Even if we're running people who aren't necessarily the best candidates in the world, we're going to run people for county commission. We're going to run them for House of Delegates. We're going to run them for the Assembly. We're going to run them for the state legislature. We're going to run them for mayor. Because that is where, you know, you can't build a pyramid with the point on the ground. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I agree with you.
And I don't see any evidence to suggest that there's any major nationwide philosophy that says that needs to be the front end of that kind. Because I say that because of what my understanding is of the way party dynamics change in this country. You know, we do have to deal with the Constitution we have. And I get real queasy when people start hollering, let's have a constitutional convention. Not because I'm in love with our Constitution, but because I know that in the era of Citizens United, what we would get.
Yeah, I know.
Okay? So we got to deal with the system that we've got. And understanding that, we have to then begin to work within it to be, I mean, if Greens want to be the people who replace the Democratic Party, then they have to have a system in place when the Democratic Party collapses. When the Whigs were dying out in the mid-19th century, you know, you had the know-nothings, and you had the little baby Republicans, and just little baby party. But you had this whole conglomeration that coalesced into the Republican Party. And within less than a generation, they had been completely transformed into a pro-business party that would, you know, anti-labor, anti-human rights, anti-anything good for working people. But
I agree with you totally. The problem is, it takes blood, sweat, and tears to run for office. It takes a lot of time. Who has that time? People that don't have to work. People that already have money. It's much easier for the aristocracy to pull this off than for working class people.
Right, and that's by design.
You've got to work. You can't run for office. Exactly. Now, Richmond, California has a green mayor. There are some pockets where they do try to put greens. Richmond is a big Chevron plant there, manufactures petroleum products and whatnot. But so it's not not a real high class place. A lot of working class people. But there are places where greens and a lot of greens do try. But it's not this democracy thing. It's not kitted out for working class people. It's kitted, and it always has been kitted out to the plutocracy, the aristocrats, the people that have the time and have the money to do it. And it takes a lot of money to run for office. It takes a lot of time and effort. You got to be 100% dedicated. It's tough. It's not kitted out for the working class. That's the problem.
It is, and sometimes, you know, as brutal as a campaign is, though, it's not that brutal to get on the ballot. For instance, you know, it's 1% of the salary to get on the ballot, and, you know, our legislators, our members of our state legislature, are not that well paid. So it might be $350.
Right, takes a bunch of signatures being sworn in, right, some money.
No, on the mountain party, oh, no, you register to run for the mountain party, you pay your filing fee, and you're there.
Well, it differs.
Yeah, I mean, it differs from state to state. But
the level position in California to run for, you have to get sworn in by an advocate. You got to pay a fee of some sort, like you said, and you have to get a certain amount of signatures. At the lowest level position for central committee in California. And even in New Jersey, when I ran for the same type of position, I had to get signatures, and I had to go in, and I had to pay a slight.
But campaigning is hard and time-consuming, but just letting people see names on ballots at this stage of the proceedings, Andy, is important.
Just get on the ballot. You can just get on the ballot. Keep getting them. At least your name gets known.
You know, we need people on the...
Great advertising just to get on the ballot.
Right. We need people on ballots at county commissioner and state legislature and Senate and things like that. We need them on the ballot.
Right.
We need people besides president and Senate and the House of Representatives. That's my only point. Right. Hey, Andy, I got to get out of here, though, because we've run out of time.
All right. Hey, real quick, Hillary Clinton, let's not forget, she's a consigliere to Walmart. She was on Walmart's board.
Absolutely.
Also, when it comes to being a warmonger, there's no bigger warmonger than Hillary Clinton when it comes to Afghanistan and Iraq. And let's not forget her landing in Bosnia-Herzegovina, saying she was under so much fire. And the guy that was actually there, who I happen to know, a Major Scott Dick, who met her there, there was no fire. There was no nothing. They just took her off the plane and took her around. She was never in a firefight. So let's stop with the Hillary Clinton. That's nuts. It would be 10 times worse with Hillary.
Now, my only objection is the really... No, my only objection is the really...
I hope you're listening, Jim.
My only objection is the really crappy way that people like Hannity treated her because she had a concussion. You know, so, you know, these things do happen to everybody.
Well, she's working herself to death. I mean, you could even see it on in her face even before that.
Yeah, and so, you know,
I'm
sensitive to this because I had an aunt, my favorite aunt, when I was a little boy, had a fall and hit her head, and a couple of weeks, a month later, she was dead from a blood clot on the brain.
Wow.
And I think, you know, and I think about Sean Hannity making sport of this woman, and it just goes to show how utterly evil and sleazy they are.
Absolutely.
Andy, have a good night, my friend.
Hey, thanks a lot. Great New Year.
Hi, you too. Bye now. Wonderful evening's conversation. Thanks everybody for your participation, for joining in. We will fire it up and do it again tomorrow. And I hope you'll add the weight of your conversational skills to the process. We never got past the halfway mark to Shirley's challenge, so that remains on the table for, until tomorrow. So, if you care to help out, by all means, please feel free to do so. If you can't get to the PayPal button, you can always, just sign into your own PayPal and use, the address that's tied to our PayPal account, Bob Kincaid, BOBKINCAID @gmail.com. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go, our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Betsy, moderators in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, my lovely wife, Agnes, for help with the post, John Fox for all of his technical expertise. Thanks to Ben Birch for creating and then running for, these 10 years now, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AcheAct.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Here comes Rick Smith on the horn.